Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with a globally top-ranking distinguished executive, scientist, engineer, Dr. Kishore Swaminathan, chief scientist at Accenture, who shares his research and deep insights into global overall trends, business needs and strategy, future of technology, skill needs, and career lessons. Kishore, you bring a substantive history of significant and considerable international contribution to research, engineering, computer science, and industry to this interview. We are very fortunate to have you share your deep insights and experiences with the audience.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Kishore, can you share your experience with Artsonia and why this initiative is so important to the world?
Artsonia was a labor of love. At one point, I felt, what is something that could unleash the creativity of children around the world? And before the internet, this was like solving world hunger. So during the dot-com, the boom time, I saw a lot of my colleagues leaving their regular jobs to go start various kinds of companies. And I felt that the internet, by making the transportation of information essentially cheap or inexpensive, is in a position to do something potentially interesting. And then I asked myself, what is the most interesting thing I could think of? And I realized that children's art is one of those things that has a tremendous amount of cultural, social, artistic value, but has no market, has really no financial value at all. In the past, it was not really possible or cost-effective to build a children's art museum, whereas on the web, you could do that. And in fact, give kids all over the world an opportunity to showcase their talent. And that is how the whole thing started. And after about 5 or 6 years, we now have over 2.5-3 million pieces of art from kids in over 100 countries. And I don't know for a fact, but I would guess, this is probably the single largest collection of art anywhere. And these are from children aged all the way from 5 to 17 or 18. In terms of its importance, I think that it's best illustrated with a story. One of the kids whose art was showcased in Artsonia, he was a Canadian boy, age around 9, died in an accident. And his friends and his school as a whole, they approached Artsonia and asked us if they could create an art memorial for this kid. And the reason why they approached Artsonia is because when you think about an 8-year-old child does not leave anything behind, really, of significance. They're too young to write, but the only thing, their heritage, is the art that they can create. And we had this kid's art. So they created an online memorial for this kid. And that was one of my more satisfying moments with Artsonia.
You know, that's an amazing story to share, and I could see just the tremendous value and an ongoing value, historical value, contribution value of this project and this initiative. And, you know, it speaks to you, Kishore. It's just amazing.
Well, the two side comments I'll add about Artsonia, one is that it's not an elitist site. It's not for just the artistic kids. It is for everybody. But the only kind of art that we reject are things that kind of personally identifies kids, their faces or things that are obscene or things that have gang symbols and stuff. So it is not elitist. It accepts anything and everything. But at the same time, my hope is that with millions of kids being featured, 15 or 20 years down the line, a few of these kids are might be the future Monet or Picasso. And if that turns out to be, we will have a famous artist, you know, childhood artwork. That will be a pretty unique. That'll be a pretty unique heritage that could have been lost in the real world in the past.
You know, the other thing that I'm struck by you, Kishore, is that you've got this remarkable history and background. And if you look back, can you profile your key milestones prior to joining Accenture and then share some important lessons that you wish to pass on to the audience?
Key milestones were actually finishing my undergraduate degree was, to me, a much bigger milestone than finishing my doctoral dissertation, in fact. Because by the time I was doing my doctoral dissertation, I pretty much knew what I wanted to do. Whereas the undergraduate degree, that was the time where there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of thinking about the future, understanding who you are, where your natural inclinations lie. And so I find that was a very significant growth period for me. And in terms of some of the lessons that I've learned, so here are a few. The world at large thinks of science as dispassionate, and you follow a scientific method as dispassionately as possible. And in fact, doing science, the scientific method is dispassionate, but scientists are fairly emotionally sensitive people, because in order for somebody to be creative, in order for somebody to chase butterflies, an idea that may or may not pan out, you almost have to be a little bit irrational. So while science involves the scientific method, scientists are often somewhat emotional and irrational, and that's a good thing. The second thing that I've kind of learned is that if you really want to be creative and do something new, you have to have some intellectual arrogance. You almost have to reject the current reality and say, no, there should be a different way of doing that. And that requires a certain boldness and arrogance. And in fact, one of my heuristics, if I'm asked to solve a problem, the way I approach it is I imagine somebody I know, a very smart colleague, and then say, how would he solve it? And then try to do it differently. So that's another thing that I've learned. Then I also find that reality has many layers that you can look at. You can look at one version of reality and start making judgments. But when you understand why things are the way they are, and when you go a little bit deeper, you understand a different reality. When you dig deeper, you understand a different reality. So to give you an example, I went to China as part of an academic delegation about 15 years back. At that time, China was not, it was still a difficult country. There were few hotels in the big cities. The boom hadn't started. And I had all the normal, both concerns and conceptions that Americans have about China, which is, you know, there's no freedom of expression and how horrible it is, and communist and so on and so forth. Then when I got there, because I was part of an academic delegation, I was able to talk to a lot of professors, and a lot of them were actually U.S. educated professors. And I found from them that what we consider to be censorship and so on, they did not think about it that way at all. They thought about it as, here is a very, very large country, very large population, and it cannot change overnight, okay? Because they had just seen the chaos that the Soviet Union had seen when Soviet Union basically disintegrated. Instead, there has been a very orderly long-term change in China, and I saw that 15 years back, only because I was there, I was able to talk to the people. And the world conception still about, you know, countries like Iran or countries like China is based on essentially one view of reality. But when you dig deeper, that you begin to understand more and more, and in other words, reality has many different layers. Here is something that I find to be true as a heuristic for a scientist. You can get credit or you can have influence, but don't ask for both. So in other words, if you have an idea, if you do some work, in order for the work to have influence, other people have to internalize it. And once they begin to internalize, they begin to take ownership, and the idea goes without you much farther. If you take credit for it all the time, then it is so closely associated with you that other people cannot take ownership. And as a result, you get credit, but you don't have a lot of influence.
That's pretty sound advice. I mean, did some of it get shaped when you were at the India Institute of Technology?
Most of these, except my story about China. That was after I was in the U.S.
You know, when you look back then, what are the key disruptive forces that have been driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
A very disruptive force at the moment is my teenager. She is a senior in high school, and she'll be going to college in September. And we don't quite know where she will go yet. And when she goes to college, when you leave her, at some point, you have to basically say, turn back and go home. That is going to be pretty hard. Other disruptive forces are, more and more, I find myself working with people in different time zones. And people, because of the globalization of business, and working with people in different time zones constantly is very disruptive, both for your life and their life. Either you have to work certain odd hours or they have to. As a result, certain regular habits that you want to have, such as, you know, work out at a certain regular time, these things do begin to take a toll. Another disruptive force in my life, I would say, is actually related to aging. I've had excellent memory, and as a result, I never developed the skill for taking notes. Everything was in my head. But as I get older, I no longer have the excellent memory that I used to have, and not being able to, it's taking notes is not an easy skill. Somehow people develop it. I find it very hard to take notes and listen to somebody at the same time. So as a result, that is something that definitely affects my effectiveness.
Kishore, you have a number of leadership roles, or have had them in the past and continue to this present and into the future. So what are some lessons that you can share from this, you know, from these leadership roles and to be an effective leader?
In my career, I have seen two very different kinds of leadership styles. One style is the leader processes the information and then tells the troops, his or her direct reports, what they are supposed to do. The other leadership style, which is kind of what I have come to practice, is tell your subordinates everything you know about a project, about a task. By doing that, you are giving them a lot of context. Sometimes very junior folks, they're almost bored by this. Why are you telling me all this? Just tell me what subroutine I'm supposed to write, right? But by insisting on giving them the overall context over a period of time, they grow into very trusted lieutenants because they know how you think and they have much broader context. Therefore, you can trust and delegate. So I think communication, all-round communication about your organization, about the task, about the project to your subordinates, I think is a way of building them to be leaders in the future, as well as for you to be more effective because you can have a set of lieutenants you can trust. The second thing in which I'm not sure I'm very good at, but I think is a very important important characteristic of leadership is follow through. If you say you will do something or get something done, you really have to take it seriously. Because when you have the follow through, that's when others can really trust you and you get additional responsibilities. Certain other lessons, I never put anybody on a critical path that I have not worked with in the past. I start with, if it's a new person, either a subordinate or a colleague, until I have that level of comfort that this person will follow through, that this person understands the overall context for what we are trying to accomplish, I will not put them on my critical path to success. Then finally, I would say it's important for in terms of leadership, it's important to sometimes stay away from the day-to-day fires, because if you choose to get involved in putting out every little fire in a project, then that's all you'll be doing. You'll kind of almost have to, a lot of these problems, the little crises that happen in projects, a file has been deleted, a server goes down, somebody is sick, we are behind by a week, all of these kind of begin to they sort out by themselves. So unless and until something really needs your intervention, stay away from it and give your subordinates a chance to solve it for themselves.
You know, those are very, very good lessons, and I can see them even applying in terms of some of the things that I do. So I can very much relate. Excellent. What are your current roles with Accenture, and how will you shape your vision in the next 5 years?
In Accenture, I have two distinct roles and responsibilities. As the chief scientist of the company, my role is to define the company's vision, technology vision for the future. And because Accenture is not a product company, the vision really acts as the anchor for it's our reading of where the world of technology is going, and that acts as the anchor for our internal investments, areas of business that we should consider, what are the new opportunities, as well as advising our clients on their technology strategy. So that is my chief scientist role. I'm also Accenture's director for technology research, and in that role, I manage a group of researchers, most of whom are computer science PhDs, with a few electrical engineering folks also thrown in there, across 4 locations, 2 in the U.S., 1 in France, and 1 in Bangalore. My vision for my own future is that I want to get seriously into writing. I do a lot of speaking currently, but I think writing has a lot more leverage, and I want to get very seriously into writing And then my other, in the role of director of research, my vision is to make the Accenture Technology Labs among the top, you know, labs in the world. In terms of, there are lots of very good research labs around the world and academic departments. I want to bring something unique to our researchers, and that is what I talked about earlier, the intellectual arrogance and boldness, so that they have the courage to tackle problems that others have tried but not solved. They have the courage to say, I can solve it, and if I don't solve it, it's okay. Have the courage to fail. That is the unique characteristic that I want to build in my researchers.
You know, you indicated writing as sort of a personal vision in terms of where you want to do additional concentration. Are there certain particular themes that you want to write about?
Yes, there are many global problems, or, you know, significant global challenges that are pretty well recognized, such as global warming, such as population, and so forth. But there is one phenomenon that doesn't get that much attention, and that is the growth of mega cities. So if you look at Mexico City, Sao Paulo, Calcutta, Mumbai, Shanghai, these mega cities are when you have 10 or 15 million people in very close confines, providing them with everything from water to sewage to infrastructure to information to education and safety. These are very big, massive challenges. And I don't think any city has really solved that. So the specific area that fascinates me is how, and many of these cities, particularly in the emerging world, are continuing to grow. What fascinates me is how can technology help with both, you know, not needing the people to migrate to the cities so that they can work from their villages and so on. So in one way, not making the cities bulkier and bulkier. And secondly, how technology can help the cities to be a lot healthier and safer than they currently are. This is the area that I want to do some serious research in and write about.
Well, that's fascinating, and you know, will have a lot of impact. You know, earlier you talked about your current roles, you know, a chief scientist, a director of technology research, you know, visioning to having the top labs and so on. So in your current roles, what are the biggest challenges, and then what are your proposed solutions?
My biggest challenge in my role as a director of research is making people understand, including my junior researchers, understand that research and creativity, these are not linear processes, that progress does not accrue based on the amount of time you have put into it. So you may not have much to show for a month or 2 months, and suddenly one day everything clicks and you have a tremendous amount of progress. Now, my management doesn't always understand, so trying to do status reporting on research projects in businesses is actually quite hard. But even more than that, for me, the day-to-day challenge is counseling my junior researchers that if you don't have anything useful to do, don't worry about it. Take the day off. Go to a conference, right? Do not keep kind of busy because you feel guilty otherwise, because creativity and research, it's not a linear process.
What are your major initiatives and tactics to develop talent and creativity amongst computing and business professionals?
I think in a globalized world, and with people being, with the technology that enables you to work from pretty much any place, in the future, both computing professionals and business professionals, I think they have to have kind of three very distinct qualities. One quality is the ability to work without supervision. Second is to work or manage ambiguity. Lots of tasks, as I see the world, lots of things in the future are going to be more and more ambiguous. So I think individuals should need to develop the ability to tolerate ambiguity and then basically make a decision one way or the other and go on with it. And I think the third ability that people need is what is in the popular press known as the ping quotient, right? The ability for you to just ping somebody, or the ability having a large enough network of people who you can tap on their shoulders from time to time, not necessarily for long-term collaboration, but hey, I have a question about this. Can I just bother you for a minute? The larger the number of people that you can just contact very casually and without a lot of structure, the more effective you're going to be. So to summarize, I think the ability to work without supervision, the ability to manage ambiguity, and the ability or having a network that you can tap into very casually without a lot of structure, I think these are going to be very important for business and computer professionals.
You know, you talk about developing networks. Do you find value then in having computing and business professionals join formal organizations or nonprofit organizations or societies and so on?
Well, yes, definitely. And those are the more traditional means. And going to conferences, being part of various guilds or professional societies, they kind of help you create these networks in a much more formal way. What technology also now provides is something else in addition to all of this, and that is to be able to, so you ask me about pretty much anything, right? I probably know somebody who I can instant message at any time of the day because some of them are in different time zones, and somebody will be able to get me an answer. And that is a new ability that we all have. And being able to develop that is going to be crucial.
Can you share your thoughts on completely rethinking how large-scale business systems will be architected, designed, built, managed, and operated?
Okay. That's a pretty big question. If you look at today's systems, today's business systems, they are still inside the firewall. They have been designed typically with a relational database, and they are expected to run kind of at a certain, provide a certain degree of performance, and there's an underlying assumption that every few years the computers will get faster, and therefore, as there's more need for, as this application needs to process more data, just the computing power will take care of it. I think all of these are changing. Fundamentally, I would say we are at the cusp of what I would call fourth generation system development. The first generation being mainframes, the second generation being the client server architecture, the third generation being essentially a web-based architecture. In the fourth generation, a lot of things that we took for granted are no longer true. So, for example, the relational model is not very conducive for supporting a lot of parallel computation to the extent that computer chips are not going to get much faster because of various heat problems. We are coming to the end of the traditional Moore's law. Essentially, they're not getting faster by increasing the speed. Instead, they have multiple chips built on them to provide essentially the same throughput. As a result, the world is going to become more and more parallel. Our systems are going to become more and more parallel. Lots of different threads working simultaneously to solve a problem. Writing code that is parallel, architecting data that is conducive or that supports the parallelism, and then finally, being able to architect for the so-called cloud computing, all of these put together, it's going to be a new ball of wax. And that is our overall conclusion. And a lot of our research is aimed at this so-called fourth generation system development, which is most likely your future systems are going to be outside your enterprise firewall, or some of it is inside, some of it is outside, and integrated somehow. Again, data is going to be distributed, and it has to support multiple devices, not just a laptop or just Windows operating system, but it has to run on all the way from laptops to iPhones to Blackberries to whatever. So the user interface and the user experience of how they're going to use the system, that is changing. The architecture is changing. The data format is changing. At the chip level, the architecture is changing. So all of these are areas of research.
I see. So I guess you would see challenges, though, right now in terms of having massively multi-core architectures, and there would have to be some breakthroughs to address that.
Yes, yes. And one of the parallelization, this is not a new area. There has been research for the last 30 years. But what we are on the cusp of is most traditional research toward parallelization aimed at taking very complex algorithms that were computationally very expensive and trying to parallelize them. In the world of multi-core architectures, grid architecture, and cloud computing, where I can buy as many servers as I want, here parallelism is not taking an algorithm and trying to parallelize it. Here it's taking a system for example, a web server might be serving 10,000 users. Now, you may parallelize it by putting it on 5 different servers, each serving 1,000 users. You haven't parallelized the algorithm per se, whereas you have parallelized the execution. And there have to be some breakthroughs, and in fact, we do have a couple breakthroughs ourselves so far.
You know, can you profile the major global trends that we need to anticipate and then leverage for success?
Some of them I already talked about. I see 4 kind of global trends or challenges that I see will have a very significant effect, significant impact on how we live, how we work, how we play in the future. One is resource contention. Resources all the way from metal to oil. As the populations grow, as the emerging world has more purchasing power and life conditions become better, the contention for resources is going to be pretty intense, and that is something we need to anticipate. Second, I don't have any particular expertise, but I do believe this is an important change that's going to drive change throughout the world, and that is everything to do with climate change and the carbon footprint. Third, I already talked about, and that is the growth of mega cities. And then fourth, this may be perhaps the toughest, this is what I anticipate, and may be the toughest to address and even address, let alone solve. That is our continued society's continued confusion between progress and growth. Growth is not always progress, and progress does not always entail growth. So I think having grown up in India, I'm seeing it there, and having been to China, I've seen it there, that emerging societies, they kind of tend to confuse, not just emerging societies, all societies do, but particularly the case in point in these two countries with very large populations is that there's a confusion of between if we are progressing economically, that also means certain kind of growth. And that, I believe, is probably not going to be sustainable. And a lot of our populations, in lots of different societies, we have grown economically, life conditions have gotten better, life expectancy has gotten better, but I'm not convinced people are any happier, people have any more leisure, and these are the kinds of things that are never measured. So, is that progress? I'm not sure. We definitely have growth.
So if we could now sort of focus on the business side then, what are the major challenges for business today and how can they be solved?
I would say the biggest challenge for businesses, sometimes we kind of call this very trivially as outsourcing, that is getting rid of things that I don't want. I think there's something much deeper that is going on. When the cost of communication was very high, then a company existed as a way of essentially circumscribing a group of people and managing their activities and their communication. As the cost of communication goes down, especially with the internet, globally I can communicate, then the notion of a company as a strict boundary goes away. There is really no inside and an outside. Because if I can share, if employees can, across companies can collaborate, if systems can work with each other across different companies, if you can execute common business processes across different companies, then there is no clear boundary as to where one company ends and another company starts. So understanding that companies are really poor, they're going from very rigid boundaries to highly porous entities where, some processes are inside, some processes are outside, some processes are, handled by in partnership. This has a lot of new challenges, such as our traditional notions of intellectual property will have to change. Our traditional notions of very transactional relationships between companies, that has to change. There's going to be a lot more of longer-term partnerships. Then the traditional notions of things like enterprise value, Mark, what is the value of my company? That in the past, there were good methodologies to measure because you knew what that company was. You knew where it started, where it ended. But as companies become more porous, the value of my company is not completely within my company. It is also in the quality of the partnerships I have, in the value of the other companies with whom I have a long-term partnership, okay? And the risk and the sustainability of those companies as well. So a lot of things depend, our traditional notion of value, intellectual property, how do I build capacity, how do I scale a company, how do I grow a company, all of this has been based on the assumption that a company had a very clear boundary, someplace it started, someplace it ended. And when companies are no longer, completely self-contained and are porous, a lot of these traditional notions have to change. And that is going to be a pretty big challenge from a managing the business standpoint, from managing the intellectual property, signing contracts, all of those. But also from the worker's standpoint, socially and culturally, because I think a lot of people, so many people in Accenture, they work for Accenture, but they also work for our clients. And if it's a very long-term project, their paycheck comes from Accenture, but they work for the client. So who are they really working for? People have to come to terms with the fact that they'll be working for a lot of different employers. Some of them they don't even know they are working for.
You know, that's a lot of food for thought, and I guess it reflects, all of the changes that are occurring, and even that I would say relates to the demographic shifts as well, right? Because people are more open to these ideas of open spaces and amorphous boundaries and, this so global aspect. There's technology trends that also tie into this. So in your view, then, what are these major technology trends, and what do we need to do to take advantage of them?
Well, I can tell you right from my technology vision that I see kind of seven major trends, kind of at least looking in the next 3 to 5 years. One is definitely cloud computing. I'm more and more convinced that it's not hype, it's real, it has legs. Then the second trend is, even as we speak, I think there's a new web in the offing. The very infrastructure of the web is being changed. There are new protocols being proposed. There are suddenly the web is no longer an information experience. It is becoming more and more of a social experience. HTML5 makes location a first-class object. It's no longer about how to draw a page. It is about how to create a container that contains people, information, location, content of various different sorts, and objects like equipment, like my smart meter could very literally be running a web browser. So the new web, I think I don't understand all the implications of it, but it's definitely being changed. It's not Web 2.0, which referred mostly to how people use the web differently. What I'm referring to is that the infrastructure of the web itself is changing. The third trend that I see is a proliferation of devices. It's no longer useful to think about a mobile phone, a mobile device as a phone. For all practical purposes, it's a computer with a different form factor for which I can buy software from a lot of different vendors. In the past, with a phone, whatever the Samsung or Motorola gave you, that's all you had. But things like the iPhone have shown that you can, in fact, corral a lot of third-party developers. And as such, the modern mobile device is a computer with a different form factor. So as a result, I see a proliferation of devices. And today, my device, let's say my iPod, it combines both the experience that I have of the music, as well as the access I have to the music, because it's stored right there. As more and more of the content begins to move to the cloud, I think devices will become, will focus not on access, but on experience. So I can have the same content in different devices, and they provide very different experiences. The fourth trend that I see is social, the whole social media combined, it's creating, I think, a new economy that I would call the conversation economy. So a lot of people are having various kinds of conversations, and they are spending a lot of time having these conversations. And how to use these conversations, how to create an economy out of it. When lots of people are doing something that they are passionate about, there is some economics behind. It is right now we still continue to think about the web as just advertising as the engine that drives it, but I think there's probably lot more economics in all these conversations. So let me to give you an example. When a lot of consumers are, as part of their discussions, if they are referring to a company or a brand or a product, the ability to mine that information in order for a company to understand its brand value or the sentiment that the consumers have about their brand or that company or that product, or being able to see the conversations that people have as a continuous focus group, these are all potential ways of monetizing these conversations. And so that is in the very, very early stages, and I think that is going to be a very important trend. And then collaboration. Collaboration is still fairly painful because of firewall issues, because people have asymmetric capabilities. If I have a nice video conferencing, whatever, and if all you have is email, we always have to go to the lowest common denominator. So the combination of the lack of infrastructure, the firewalls, asymmetric capabilities, and then also another thing that I increasingly notice with a lot of companies, a lot of our own clients, their employee policies are not completely consistent with their technology policy. So HR may give you flex work that you can work from home on, say, 2 days a week or whatever, but the technology may not allow you to do everything from that you can do in the office from home, because once again, various kinds of restrictions set on what can be done inside the firewall and what can be done outside the firewall. So collaboration, I think, is a very important trend, but it's pretty slow and painful. And then finally, the seventh trend is what I called earlier, fourth generation system development, how systems are going to be developed in the future.
So what are the core drivers then for organizational success over the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years?
I believe work is structured around our ability, whatever ability we had, capability we had for communication. So we have the notion of a project today in most companies. We have the notion of a status report, milestone, metric, and a deliverable, right? Let me ask you, why do these things exist? These things exist because in the past, our communication capability was such that I could see my boss, say, once a week or once a month, and therefore I had to create milestones and status reports. When the communication capabilities changed pretty dramatically, all the way from, say, social networks to things like Twitter, they have shown that, you know, a publish and subscribe kind of model can help increase your peripheral awareness, can increase the frequency of your communication, which is you can keep in touch with your colleagues or friends or family much, much more frequently. And also, all the video the ability for people to create video and distribute it for free, it kind of makes assimilation of certain kinds of information a lot easier. So the future, the work of the future that I see is one in which there are no projects, there are no metrics, there are no plans, there are no status reports, there are no deliverables. Nobody really works for anybody. Nobody is really accountable for anything, but somehow stuff happens. Okay? Or in other words, work gets done. Because of all these new communication capabilities, I don't need a one-hour meeting with my boss to give status. My boss can be peripherally aware of the progress and the crisis in a project. Through a combination of everything from Twitter to various other publish and subscribe kind of mechanisms. When when that kind of, when communication becomes frequent and people can assimilate a lot more information through their peripheral vision, I think the work itself will become very malleable and it's almost people volunteering to finish. Today, people are assigned to a project. I foresee a future in which projects, the various projects in Accenture, advertise themselves, and then on any given day, I decide which is the project to which, based on my skills and my knowledge, which is the one I can contribute to the most. If you believe in such a future, then the traditional notions of what a company is and how work gets done, the hierarchy and accountability, all of these change to the point that a company becomes a voluntary association of a group of people, some like-minded people, with some tacit contract about how they are going to divide the revenue or the profits.
That's interesting, because then I guess that ties into motivation, so, and people having initiative and so on. And you're saying perhaps that's an intrinsic quality in all people, and that could be driven by the environment itself and not necessarily be driven by schedules and plans and so on.
Right.
You know, I guess if we look at the skills frameworks out there and the jobs, well, how is this going to change for computing professionals because of all the differences in businesses and technology and, you know, all the trends that are occurring?
I think as infrastructure, computing infrastructure gets more and more complex. So, for example, a Google data center right in Chicago, Microsoft is building its Azure data center. These are nothing like the traditional Fortune 500 data center. These have hundreds of thousands of servers, and because of the complexity, so much of it is automated, all the way from provisioning and performance tuning. The infrastructure is, the complexity requires automation. As a result, I think that there is going to be less need for people to operate the infrastructure. But there's going to be more and more need for people who can architect systems. And I think architecture is going to get a lot more complex because of different data formats, because I have to now integrate systems from different cloud providers, different software as a service providers. My data is in multiple places. I have to synchronize them. All of these are fundamentally design and architectural problems. So I think a big change in the profile of, you know, people involved in IT is there's going to be a lot less need for people who manage the day-to-day of running data centers and doing the backups and so on. A lot of those are getting automated, and the skill needs are going to be more at the architectural level.
Does that then imply that computing professionals in the future should have a better understanding of business and business needs and aligning the IT goals with the business strategies, perhaps having a better understanding of the industry domain itself, and this tied in with communication skills and interpersonal skills, relationship skills?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think so long as everything is done in-house, you focus, an IT department hired people with just mostly technical skills, and you wanted some interpersonal skills for things like project management and leadership and so forth. But we are going to be, in the future, doing a lot more sourcing of people, skills, equipment, software from multiple places. And we are going to be working with employees of other companies who may be in a different time zone. We are going to be managing people in different time zones, different cultures, and some of them working from home. So when you put all these things together, the future computing professional is not going to be a geek. I think the age of the geeks is over. The future computing, yes, there'll always be room for the startup geeks and so forth, but if you look at the IT in large companies, it is going to be people with a lot of business knowledge as well as interpersonal skills, the ability to, you know, relate to people from different cultures and work across different time zones and work under a lot of ambiguity. And that's a much better rounded person rather than a purely technical person.
You know, we've discussed a lot of topic areas, and have shared a lot of insight. So what are your top recommended resources and for what reason?
Increasingly, this, I don't mean to be facetious, I find Wikipedia to be among my top resource. I think humanity has done, there are two things that humanity has done almost completely with volunteers, with no plans, no metrics, no nothing. One is Wikipedia, but there is something else, and I would say this is probably the biggest open source endeavor I can think of, and that is the Appalachian Trail. The Appalachian Trail runs from northern Maine to somewhere in Georgia or Tennessee, I think, over some of the most rugged terrain. And it was built entirely by volunteers with no centralized planning, with no centralized control. And it took about 20, 25 years. And it is still owned by a not-for-profit foundation, not by the U.S. Department of Interior. And it is, if you read the history of the Appalachian Trail, that I think will, for any computer professional, that will give a much better sense of what makes open source movements work.
Sure. In your travels, you know, you've seen a lot. You've interacted with a lot of people, with a lot of different kinds of events. You've got this remarkable history of accomplishment. Are there any stories you want to share from this work and from your experiences?
I often conduct what we call innovation workshops. So fairly senior folks from our client companies will get together for a day, and we talk about technology and technology developments and business developments, challenges of the company and the industry and so forth. And we show them new prototypes and how the industry could change with the advent of one technology or the other. At the end of the day, when you open up the discussion and then basically ask, so now that you've seen all this, now that you've heard all this, what can you do with it? I generally get silence. But a few years back, I learned a very simple trick. And that is, when you talk about all the new possibilities, then ask the client, what do you think your competitor can do with it? Suddenly ideas start flowing. And I always find it very amusing. When you ask them, what can you do with it? Nobody can think of anything outside the box. But the moment you ask them to be in the shoes of a competitor, they kind of, you know, all the juices start flowing. I think this is actually fairly important, because when you ask somebody, what can you do, they get caught up in all the little details. Well, we could do this, but Bob will never approve this, right? All their internal petty politics. The moment you ask them, what can a competitor do, suddenly, the competitor is a black box and they can do anything. So I don't know if that's a story, but that I found something amusing in my experience. In terms of little stories, I can think of a couple. Once I gave a talk, a presentation at some conference, and I had my lapel mic, and then my talk was over. The next speaker had gone on. I didn't realize that my mic was still on. So I was talking to my colleague who was sitting next to me and kind of partly criticizing the current speaker. And the whole thing was audible to the whole audience. That was a pretty embarrassing moment. Another more recent story is I was in a foreign country. I won't name the country. It's in Asia. And I had a very funny video that I showed. And in the U.S., when I show this, you know, I get tremendous amount of laughter from the crowd. It's a spoof about what the iPhone can do. That it's a bottle opener, it's a hair dryer, and you know, anything you can think of. But in this country, I showed the video. There was dead silence in the room, and then later, few people came to me and said they assumed it was real, that the iPhone can in fact open bottles, that the iPhone in fact is a hairdryer too. All these are features that are coming. They just assumed it was true. It made me realize I don't think it was just the language that was the issue here. It is different senses of humor.
Well, it's interesting. I got a big smile on my face just listening to these stories, and yeah, it's quite remarkable. Anyways, we're down to the near, you know, the end of our interview, and I have a couple more questions left. And this next question is if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and that would be your, and what would be your answers?
I'll answer the first part of your question, but not the second part. So, in other words, I will tell you what questions I would ask, but I won't tell you my answer. The question I would ask, I generally ask of people, is who are their role models? Oftentimes, that tells me a little bit about the person. The second question I would have asked is, what are your big disappointments in life? And the third question I would have asked is, how do you deal with extreme stress? Not day-to-day stress, but kind of duress. How do you act under duress?
Those are great questions. I guess I can't reach out and say, hey, what would be your answers? Okay, we're down to our last question, and that is, there is this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, and they have this initiative called IP3, which is a program on professionalism and creating the IT profession. Do you have any comments on this and how it could improve the IT industry?
More and more, when people write code, the code can affect people's lives. If the code is going to go into a robot and the robot goes haywire, somebody could be hurt. Or if the code goes into an X-ray machine and the X-ray machine doesn't shut off after whatever 3 seconds, somebody could be, you know, seriously fried. So computing professionals are no longer just operating calculators that churn out some numbers. They are operating they are writing code that operates a lot of physical equipment that can hurt, kill, maim, all the defense equipment, for example. Most of it is automated. So I think one of the something that is seriously missing from the whole field, whether I look at university curricula or, you know, various company training programs, is education on occupational safety. Because writing code is no longer about just writing correct code. It is about understanding that, you know, various aspects of safety, because you are in a position to do serious damage. Then, especially because writing code now manages our, you know, your finances, my finances, and our identity or credit rating and so forth, a certain level of ethics, all the way from people who operate data centers to people who write code, a certain level of ethics, I think, is crucial so that they don't leave Trojan horses and trapdoors and code that others can exploit or they can exploit themselves. I think the IP3 is an interesting first step, but I think we need to go a lot farther. And so when Google says their motto is do no evil, I think they are at the beginning of recognizing that the IT computing is in a position, is big and powerful enough to do evil. And as a result, there has to be both regulatory and more than regulatory, almost kind of a self-governing approach to professionalism, ethics, and safety. And I would go so far as to suggest that we probably need to invent something like the equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath that that doctors take, right? Because we are also in a position to hurt, kill, maim, ruin somebody's life by our mistakes.
Well, Kishore, you have taken us on just an amazing journey today, and you have so many insights and such a deep and also broad perspective of the global situation of business and industry and society, of countries, I mean, technology, you name it. It's been an amazing time, and I thank you for coming in today to do this interview, and we will continue to follow your many significant global and historical contributions. So again, thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights and experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much, and I hope this helps one person that will make me happy.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with globally top-ranking, distinguished executive, scientist and engineer, Dr. Kishore Swaminathan, Chief Scientist, Accenture. Kishore shared his deep insights into global overall trends, business needs and strategy, the future of technology, skills needs, career lessons, and much, much more.